Well, that is Chumbawamba from 1993, one of the Peel sessions, and Time Bomb. Welcome back to BCFM's politics show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, now departed, and me, Tony Gosling. Thousands of British personnel helping create the world's biggest humanitarian crisis in Yemen. We hear the details now. The poorest country in the Middle East being ground into the dirt by our great ally, Saudi Arabia. The unelected monarchy in charge there, with tens of billions flowing back to Britain in arms sales and paying for staff helping the slaughter of the Yemenis. And all to aid the so-called President Saleh of Yemen, imposed by the West, who's not even allowed to turn up at the Saudi peace talks, for what they're worth. Somerset's Dr. Judith Brown, who worked for the UN in Yemen, is here to explain what our mass media won't tell us and our MPs don't want to hear about the genocide Britain is profiteering from in the Arabian Peninsula. As a former nurse, Judith also was outspoken about what she sees as the irrationality of the government's COVID-19 response and points out some of the contradictions. Masks were useless, according to the government and the World Health Organization, but suddenly they're compulsory. How very Orwellian. We ask, is the pandemic a psychological operation where we're not supposed to notice these contradictions? And they strip us eventually of our civil liberties bit by bit. If COVID-19 was man-made, as the former MI6 chief Richard Dearlove suggested, you just heard him in the first hour last week, splicing the SARS and the AIDS poisons onto the common cold, are we not dealing just with a pandemic or ID 2020 vaccine ID system, which we all are supposed to partake in, but also with an evil agenda to enslave humanity?
My name's Judith Brown. I started my life as a nurse and ended up as an aid worker, working in Africa and in the Middle East, which I loved, in Lebanon and Yemen. I was a manager of refugee health programs, so I went to places where there were refugees, first of all into Burundi, where there were Rwandan refugees, Lebanon, where there were refugees from Palestine, and then later into Yemen, where there were very generous to refugees and had a lot of refugees from Africa and also other Middle East countries, although they were a minority, places like Iraq, for example, the refugees from Saddam Hussein's regime. To my mind, there's one thing that's remained really constant, and that is wherever refugees come from and wherever refugees go, in general, refugees are not welcome. And I've never known a country which has been very receptive to refugees. Ultimately, they have to accept them, but there is discrimination against them. In fact, I think that Yemen, if anything, was one of the most accepting countries of refugees, but still underneath it, there was a sort of resentment that perhaps Somali refugees could get jobs and poor Yemeni people couldn't, and that was a fact.
So what were you actually doing as part of that job?
I was, Yemen has a very different program to everywhere else because refugees weren't housed in camps, but because refugees, Yemen was so poor, there was a refugee program for urban refugees. And so it was a question of organizing health centers, making sure that ordering medicines in for the health centers so that they were equipped, appointing staff, negotiating with the UN, both in terms of the things that they were going to fund in the program, and also negotiating when you had people who had quite severe healthcare problems that couldn't be coped with in Yemen, negotiating with third countries so that they could be repatriated to a third country.
So Yemen is the world's biggest humanitarian crisis right now. I mean, I think we're looking at literally hundreds of thousands of dead. After, is it now around about 4 years of fighting?
Five and a half years of fighting.
Crikey, yes. It's amazing how time flies, isn't it? And how are they coping now we're in this international pandemic? Maybe we could start actually just by looking at the toll that this has taken on Yemen, and maybe why you think Yemen is the place where this has been happening, somewhere you're quite familiar with.
Yeah, well, actually, that in a sense is a question that that I haven't been able to answer for myself in 5.5 years, because there's no logical reason why Yemen should be destroyed by its neighbours, except of course that Yemen. Yemeni people have tended to have more democratic and tolerant attitudes than most of
it. Didn't they? I mean, it was an ex-British colony. Didn't they have a Marxist government at one point?
They did in the south, yes, not in the north, and the north is the most populous part. But they had really tried for a democracy. It's the only republic in the area. All the others are absolute monarchies, like Saudi Arabia, Oman, you know, its neighbours, and lots of the other GCC countries. So, in fact,
that's
all
the Gulf Cooperation Council.
Gulf Cooperation Council countries, Kuwait. They're all absolute monarchies. Of course, now you've got a situation where the other two that aren't absolute monarchies, Iraq and Syria, are also being destroyed bit by bit.
Well, yeah, but these absolute monarchies, I mean, obviously it's not democratic, but they're incredibly prosperous. Places like Bahrain, Emirates, Saudi Arabia?
They are prosperous, but the interesting thing is how much their wealth has actually been going down in the last 5 years since they've been partaking in these wars. I mean, for example, the funds in Saudi Arabia have already gone down by a third in 5 years. So it is quite interesting, because I think that sooner or later the non-stop fighting of wars is going to exact an economic toll on those countries, and maybe make them more vulnerable to Western pressure.
Well, possibly. Anyway, let's look at the actual toll in Yemen. How's the country been transformed over these 5.5 years?
Well, I think that the main thing that's caused most of the damage is the overhead aerial bombardment. I personally think that none of the parties that are fighting in Yemen deserve any support. I know some people think that the Houthis deserve support, but they're the remnants of the old monarchy. And the things that they're doing are as barbaric as any other group. And so,
are they both supported? I mean, the various factions, in maybe you could just take us through who they are. And are they supported from outside the country or what?
Yes, both Saudi Arabia has long, over decades, been supporting groups in Yemen that destabilise the government in Yemen, and are supporting a lot of militias there now. UAE is also supporting militias, and generally speaking, the militias of UAE and Saudi Arabia spend a lot of time fighting each other. But the aerial bombardment, which has been going on, has actually destroyed much of the infrastructure, the economic infrastructure, which has made work in Yemen totally.
What I've heard is that there are no military targets left in Yemen.
No, but they seem to do quite well at bombing a lot of civilian targets. And of course, there are still a lot of militias on the ground. So where they know that those militias are located, then they are also targets. But a lot of the things, for example, if there was a cholera outbreak, the targets tend to be water plant, a sewage plant, and hospitals that have been built for cholera victims. So there seems to be a targeted pattern there. Also, there's been a pattern in targeting a lot of agricultural units, so that people in Yemen can find it much more difficult to grow and move their own food around.
Okay, so it's not just the military victims, you know, the people who have been bombed, killed, shot. It's also those that have been dying of starvation and dying of diseases as well.
Yes.
So it's a pretty horrific situation.
It is.
Anyway, can we just go back and clarify the main factions involved here?
Well, the main factions, well, obviously one that you've heard of, the Houthis, they're the remnants of the old king, Makalawite kingdom of Yemen. They were absolute monarchy in Yemen.
Oh, so is this before
Before 1967, oh, okay. Before 1960s, and because they were the remnants of the old kingdom, then they had been denied a lot of benefits by the rulers of the republic, and eventually a lot of people became very poor. From the Bakil tribe that mostly the Houthis are drawn from, and because they became so poor and impoverished, a movement was started, which is not a tribe, called Believing Youth. That tribe eventually was attacked by the government. It was just a movement. It didn't have any militias. But because they were constantly attacked by the government, Saleh, the president, they eventually became a militarized unit and became very good at fighting, because they'd been fighting the government.
Okay,
so we're
looking at Saleh and... And I probably pronounce it badly, Saleh and the Houthis, but the two basic factions.
Yeah, there were two basic factions. But then, strangely enough, at the beginning of the war, Saleh and the Houthis joined forces against Hadi, and who was the incumbent president. Obviously, most of the Yemeni forces backed Saleh and the Houthis, which meant that Hadi hadn't got an army in Yemen that he could ask to fight on his behalf. So what he did was ask Saudi Arabia if they would fight to restore him.
And they kindly stepped up to the plate. Wonderful Saudi Arabia. So, but the British are very, very much involved in this, aren't they?
They are indeed. The British particularly...
We British, should
yeah,
I say.
Yeah, the British are particularly involved, because it's not just the sales of weapons, which a lot of countries are doing, but they actually supply under what they call existing contracts 7,000 personnel that keep the war machine oiled and moving. They even do things like, for example, loading bombs onto planes. So if the British pulled out, in fact, the war would have to stop within 2 weeks.
Well, we're talking about thousands of people, but they're not all British, are they? Are the British employing them and kind of, yeah, being managing those
people? I think there are 7,000 British people. Those companies may be employing some other personnel, but there are actually 7,000 British people working on the war effort. Some of those are military and some of them are civilians, but there are 7,000 British people there.
Well, that's an incredible number. And so what about the control from abroad? Because I think that's the interesting thing, especially when you get a president that suddenly finds that he can't command an army in his own country, and he has to get help from abroad. So there's obviously a lot of it outside interference.
Well, it's interesting with Hadi, who is the least charismatic and least popular person in Yemen. For example, when Theresa May went to Saudi Arabia to talk about the Yemen war, she never met Hadi. She only met the people from Saudi Arabia, the foreign ministers, the war ministers and whatever of Saudi Arabia. So he's not only sidelined by his own people, but he's also sidelined by the people that are so-called fighting on his behalf. His views are never important. He's never interviewed. Is of no significance to them whatsoever. And even one of the BBC people, she went to a peace conference about a year after the war started, and she was talking to people then from Arab countries, and they actually said, well, Hadi is never going to, he's of no consequence, he's never going to be president again. And although a lot of people thought that, to actually hear his allies that were meant to be fighting in order to restore him actually making that statement openly was, you know, quite eye-opening.
Well, also, of course, one of the reasons that he's still in power is because he gets a credible reporting from the Western press. I mean, how has that happened?
Yes.
Even though, as you say, he's uncharismatic and that he's got no support or whatever.
Yeah, I know. It's he's just the excuse, you know, people. In fact, though, people, when they talk about your war in Yemen now, they very rarely talk about the restoration of Hadi to the presidency. But it seems to have gone a bit out of fashion. But, of course, I think that one of the quite interesting things that's happening in Yemen at the moment is there is an incredible death toll of disease going on, and two things have happened recently. First is that there have been absolutely incredible floods like Yemen has never known before, and with those floods have come huge quantities of mosquitoes, and with that, of course, lots of disease. And following on from that, the first cases of the coronavirus were identified. And so there's a phenomenal number of deaths now. If you look at people online, they're actually saying things like, something terrible is happening in Yemen. I'm constantly getting messages that my family members are dying. And a lot of people are actually saying, we don't think this can all be caused by the coronavirus, because they see the percentage of people that die in Western sort of outbreaks and compare that to what's happening with their family members.
So the next question has got to be, where are good places to go online to follow what's happening in Yemen? Because we're not getting it on... We get the odd report, you know, say, for example, on ITN or Channel 4 News, which is saying, oh, it's really terrible what's happening here, but it just comes without the analysis. So
yeah, exactly.
Is there anywhere to go for that?
Well, I mean, I think the best news source is Middle East Eye, but there is a research organisation called the Sana'a Centre for Strategic Studies, which is mostly Yemeni academics, and they do an analysis every month of what's been going on during the last month, and also they take various topics and they analyse them in depth, and I think that that's where you probably get the best information.
Okay, so we'll put some links up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk.
There is an interesting thing with the militias paid for by UAE. They do tend to be extremist Sunni militias, and certainly there have been reports by, for example, AP, that that what UAE did was to recruit people from Al-Qaeda to actually be paid and work for one of their...
Okay, so there seems to be a whole industry out there of extremist Sunnis who go from one bunch of militias or terrorist groups to the other, whoever seems to be paying the most.
I think, yeah, that is true. And if you're very poor, whoever pays the most and stops your family from starving is important. I mean, some areas like Taiz, where there are different groups fighting in different areas, I have heard, and from several sources, that some people fight for one side in the day and the other side at night. So, because that's the only way that they can support their family and stop them dying, which proves that they're only fighting in order to keep bread on the table. But there are other groups, and particularly these ones that are being employed by UAE, that actually they obviously see the Houthis in particular as being sort of like funded by Iran. To an extent they are, but there weren't so much at the beginning of the war. But so there is a sort of like an ideological anti-Shia reason for them joining in those.
So, I mean, these things are often painted, like the Northern Ireland conflict was, as, you know, Catholic versus Protestant, in this case Sunni versus Shia.
Yeah.
It seems that there's a bit more to it than that.
Oh, there is,
but
a
anyway,
lot more. Yeah.
We're talking about the coronavirus out in Yemen and the horrible situation out there, but I know you're also quite critical of the way that the virus has been being dealt with by the British government. I've spoken to you about this before when I was out in New Zealand, and I was quite refreshed to see that you brought this kind of critique to it all. I'm seeing a lot of stuff on the TV at the moment, particularly television news, saying things like the rise in the number of casualties, or the rise in the number of victims. Well, of course, it's going to be a rise because you're totalling it up day by day, even though when actually the number of victims that day has fallen, they still talk about it as a rise on the television.
Yeah,
now, this to me is actually really insulting to anyone with half a brain cell what you're doing is you're talking about a rise, when actually what's happened is there's been a fall in the number of coronavirus. It does seem that they're kind of talking it up, really.
Yeah. Well, it's quite interesting because I looked at a website which has got an article by someone who has analysed the NHS statistics, and it's shown that since sort of about the beginning of April, there's been a constant downfall in the numbers of coronavirus victims, but also it also lists the number of people who've died from non-COVID reasons, which is really high, and of course is likely to be higher because a lot of people who've been denied treatment by a health service that hasn't been allowed to operate during the last couple of months. For example, cancer people, the referrals are down. Of course, they're down because people aren't able to visit their GP.
Yeah, I mean, another thing I've noticed as well is they're talking about the... I mean, we've seen graphics where they're... I mean, it was almost the people getting their information from the television where they're saying, actually, the excess deaths at this time of year is very, very high. Well, they're not saying that many of those excess deaths are because of the lockdown.
They're actually
a direct result of the thing that is supposed to be saving lives is actually killing people.
Absolutely. And of course, this is going to go on for some time because the cancer referrals, the cancer treatment was stopped on the 15th of April, which seemed a bit strange because we'd already passed the peak at that point. So people were allowed cancer treatment until the 15th of April, and then it suddenly stopped when
we'd actually passed the peak. If you were a cynical person, you might say, well, this is just being used as a cover and an excuse for all sorts of censorship. I mean, for example, my show being taken off the air, but also of cutting back on the NHS.
Absolutely. And one thing that's quite interesting was that I tried to post this on my Facebook page, and within seconds the whole article kept disappearing, and I didn't have notification from Facebook to say that it was inaccurate information, and it was very difficult to call it inaccurate information.
Yeah, because what Facebook normally do is they will have a little notice saying, oh, well, I'm sorry, we've had our independent fact checkers. They never explain who those independent fact checkers are.
I posted it several times, and each time it disappeared. And so then in the end, I wrote a little summary and did the URL link to it. So I did that this morning, so I haven't checked it yet, but that seemed to stay there. But it seemed as if it was purposefully being taken down. I could actually see it on my Facebook page, and I could actually see it disappearing. So when you get sort of like factual information that's quite reassuring, it looks to me as if it's disappearing.
Okay, so there's also been, I think it's fair to say, an enormous assault on medical intellectuals who are giving a very deep expert critique. So have you seen any evidence of that? I mean, I certainly have seen some of that.
Yes, I have.
Can you give any example?
Yeah, I mean, for example, the situation of hydrochloroquine, which has been used in lots of cases in UK, in all over the world, in order to treat people with diseases that have an inflammatory immune response, such as systemic lupus, such as rheumatoid arthritis. So therefore, it was thought that maybe this, as in the cytokine storm stage of
because this is the cytokine storm is where basically the virus is creating an enormous immune response, but it's somehow managing to fight back against your T cells, your white blood cells, and whatever it is that's coming in to fight the virus. It manages to turn them into basically it fights back, and so it creates a very traumatic situation in your body,
it
which means
indeed.
That your lungs stop working.
Well, it wasn't. In fact, what's been found in terms of the COVID virus is that it particularly attacks blood vessels, and that's why people with heart disease, for example, couldn't breathe because their blood vessels that were being attacked and narrowed. And so, therefore, it was felt that maybe hydrochloroquine could be quite useful, and they combined it with a specific antibiotic that also had anti-inflammatory properties. And they did this in France and apparently had some quite good results. So then other countries in the world started copying it. But almost immediately, the World Health Authorities actually said that you couldn't use this hydrochloroquine without doing tests to see whether it was safe. Now, this was illogical because hydrochloroquine, apart from the fact that it has a long history of safety and used against inflammatory disease, has an even longer history of being used effectively for malaria. So, and there were other medications that had been used, like, for example, heparin, which wasn't being, they weren't asked to sort of like test the safety on this. Anyway, this argument went on for a time until tests were set up. Tests were set up in various countries, so you could actually then treat people with hydrochloroquine, but you were actually having to evaluate their treatment and get the consent of the person to go into the trial. But as soon as that started to happen, up came this report in The Lancet, which actually said that patients who'd been in trials in hydrochloroquine had actually deteriorated rather than improved, so all of the trials immediately stopped.
Oh, well, hang on, because that's not what I'd seen. Around about a week or maybe 10 days before that, there was a report in the Daily Mail from a New York study that said that the hydrochloroquine treatment had actually saved 50% of the COVID-19 patients that were going to die. So it was actually doing an incredible job in saving 50% of the patients. So this seems to me like what's going on here is an intellectual and a kind of propaganda battle over what is actually quite a specialist topic.
Well, if I could tell you about the article in The Lancet, it was actually linked to a small company in United States, which basically consisted of three employees, one of which was a medical person who had a dubious reputation, and the others with people like sci-fi writers and things like this. And so the article was totally discredited.
Well,
and
hang on, that's fiction, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. The article was totally discredited and had to be withdrawn. But meanwhile, of course, all of the trials had been stopped, and the numbers of patients with the COVID bacteria had actually gone down so low that it was no longer possible to have trials. I think I did hear that a trial was still continuing in the United States, but they aren't. But it seems that by having this sort of like delay tactic, it means that now you can't you can't really have any effective trials because the number of COVID sufferers has now become so low.
You said bacteria there. Was that a slip of the tongue?
It was a slip of the tongue, yes. I meant virus. Yeah, right. Sorry about that.
Okay, yeah. So, it does seem as if there's this kind of, shall we say, strategic lying going on in the international press. So when the truth starts to come out, some massive, on the wire services and in all the national press, and the international press and the television, there's a mass release of a story to kill that truth. So that, it sounds like we're moving into this kind of propaganda world.
Well, it is, because, if, for example...
You'd probably be better off and stand a better chance of staying alive if you just switch your television off completely.
Yes, indeed. Except that if you happen to become ill, my brother happened to develop a pneumonia during the COVID outbreak, wasn't able to see a doctor, became really seriously ill because he wasn't able to get medical attention. This wasn't a COVID reason.
He's here in the UK.
He's here in the UK, in London. He's younger than me. He's in his late 60s. He's he's slim built. He's fit, and yet he happened by coincidence to get this bacteria. In this case, it wasn't a virus, and it was difficult to get it diagnosed because he couldn't see a doctor. Eventually, he did get the right diagnosis. But the thing about pneumonia is it really is quite a serious disease that needs treating, and it's taken him sort of like over 2 months before he's really started to really feel that he can start going outside again. But the other strange thing, having taken antibiotics for 6 weeks, he stopped the antibiotics, and of course, as one does when one stops antibiotics, he got terrible diarrhea, and then he started feeling really ill with this diarrhea. So he rang his GP surgery to say, could he speak to the GP because he was feeling ill because he'd had this diarrhea for 3 days. And the receptionist said to him, oh, you've got to self-isolate for 2 weeks. You've got the COVID bacteria. So he was diagnosed by a receptionist on the end of the phone and still couldn't see a doctor.
Okay. So anyway, the... Off Guardian has published recently an article entitled "Is the Coronavirus a Psychological Operation?" Now, what they're saying is that it's review what the features and outcomes of the coronavirus scare, they call it. Obviously, this is a real virus. It's killing people. But it seems from what you're saying, and I certainly agree, that there's an attempt to actually massively increase the fear factor, you know, to sort of scare people using the media. In fact, the government has said, I think, in some of the published SAGE advice, that that's exactly what the media must
absolutely.
Do. And they're saying that it shares some things in common with the Red Scare that drove the perceived threat of communism and the Muslim scare behind the perceived threat of terrorism. Here are a dozen characteristics that these perceived threats share. And if you want to say anything about any of them, just stop me and we can talk about that. Fear-based and globally directed, media saturation with a bias towards fear, data manipulation and propaganda, censorship of opposing views. Now, I know, I think you probably got something to say about that, haven't you? Because, I mean, you've seen, I think, you know, and I've seen various opposing views just simply being stopped.
Absolutely. For example, Dr. Judy Mitovits was said right at the beginning that the structure of the virus was such that it couldn't have possibly been mutated on its own. It must have been a manufactured virus. And of course, it did begin in Wuhan, where they've actually got an institute of virology that does research on coronavirus, funded by US.
Actually, it's funded by the Pentagon, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know who it's funded by exactly in US, but I know it is funded by US, and it's also got links with United States universities like the University of Texas.
What you've brought up here is this big question, the big question about the virus, which is it man-made or not? Now, that hasn't really been addressed at all.
No, absolutely.
By our, you know, all the billions of pounds that goes into the national media, the international media, the BBC, etc. They really have just stepped round this question.
Absolutely,
completely.
They have, and it seems, you know, it seems that nobody has thought of this coincidence.
Except Richard Dearlove, who in the Daily Telegraph last week.
Exactly.
He's the former head of MI6.
Yeah, exactly, because Dr. Judy Mitovits was just completely wiped out from YouTube. They wouldn't accept anything of hers, and she was like totally discredited once she'd made this statement. But then up comes Sir Richard Dearlove and actually announces that this is a man-made virus that must have escaped accidentally. So he was actually on the same line. But it hasn't been, I think that although that has appeared in a mainstream newspaper, it hasn't been picked up by, for example, the BBC.
Well, the intellectuals and the government have denied it. Yeah. But then, hang on a minute, we reported, I'm talking about the BCFM politics show, when we were still on FM, I think it was the 7th of February, we reported a report, well, it was literally the week that the Chinese released a genome. In India, there was a whole load of brainstorming of virologists went on. They had a look at this genome and they said, well, over a couple of days, and they immediately released an un-peer-reviewed report saying, because of the importance of this virus, we're going to release this, and, you know, we can peer-review it at some other point, but we're going to release this straight away. And they said that they had seen SARS and AIDS protein insertions into this coronavirus. So that would make quite a good explanation as to why this coronavirus hadn't actually caused the common cold. It was doing something completely different. And it would also explain why that you've got this kind of cytokine storm and fighting back of the virus against your body's immune system.
Yeah.
So amazingly, that's what, February, March, April, May, we're now in June, that's 4 months ago.
Yeah.
This was out there, we were reporting it, now we've been taken off the airwaves.
Yeah.
It does seem as if there's an attempt to sort of steer, really to kill and strangle journalism.
Yeah, exactly. I absolutely agree with that. That it seems to me as if there is a discourse of the virus being extremely dangerous, and there is a counter discourse that's allowed because, of course, the media has to have a debate, and
it is dangerous, surely.
Yeah, that counter, well. Well, it's as dangerous as flu, and I've nursed people dying with flu. I'm not underestimating how serious a condition flu can be, but it is as dangerous as flu. But it particularly affects the elderly, and it particularly affects those who've got other diseases. I mean, for example, I think there's 1,318 people died in UK which has only got coronavirus listed on their death certificate. 1,318. So you've had a disease going around for some 4 months in which we've got 1,300 cases, 300 a month. No one would think on listening to the news that the numbers of people dying with coronavirus only is so low.
So this is another thing which is a part of the propaganda, is it's with coronavirus or of coronavirus.
Yeah.
That's another complete
Exactly. If you have somebody with end-stage cancer, or somebody with dementia, or somebody with diabetes, particularly if they're overweight with the diabetes, they seem to be much more vulnerable to dying. But they were people who were probably going to die in the near future anyway. The life expectancy of these people was probably in terms of months. So the COVID virus might have perhaps accelerated their death, but the main reason why they were dying was because they had cancer or dementia or diabetes. That was the main reason.
Okay, so yeah. We've seen, we've talked a bit about the evidence from New Delhi and from India about this being a man-made virus rather than some sort of natural thing, which the press don't seem to want to talk about. We've also seen that we can carry on, I suppose, and look through the finish off the list from this Off Guardian article. Yeah. So we would talk about censorship of opposing views, intelligence agency control of information, preceded by an exercise or exercises mimicking the threat, which we saw with the ID 2020, I think it was called Event 201, organised by Bill Gates and the CIA, which happened just before the outbreak in Wuhan, and the series of claims made that are later proven false, where we've seen a lot of that as well, in this whole COVID business. And the response is, it's got a threatened democracy. That's one of the things that all these have in common. Large increase in wealth and power for a few, increase in social inequality. Well, we've seen around about $500 billion flow into the pockets of a handful of a few billionaires, including Amazon's Jeff Bezos and Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, and increase government control of the public and reduce individual freedoms. Response kills far more than the original threat. And evidence for manufactured events. So this is, I think, well, you know, I'll put a link up on our show page to this Off Guardian article, but ultimately it ushers us towards a kind of police state that many people in Britain have embraced the lockdown. This is a great thing. We're afraid of catching this. We understand the threat.
Yeah. And the left is tending to take the line that the lockdown needs to be harsher. I know that there's other thing that's happening is that a lot of people who are actually taking some sort of power from this. I mean, just an example, there's a very nice lady, I'm not criticizing her personally, but she's where I go shopping. She's very sort of like mild and gentle sort of person. And doesn't normally have any sort of like power at all. Maybe because of her fear, or maybe because she's actually been given the power. When you go to the supermarket now, she's one of the most sort of like officious people, really. Just get back, don't stand on the other side of that line, don't. And then if you stand so that you're a little bit to the left of the Perspex screen, get back behind the Perspex screen. And she's sort of like making these commands, and I think that whereas normally she's not able to make any imposition on people, she's able to make these, to turn into this little sort of like power person.
Well, what would you say to those people who are really strong believers in the lockdown and all of this?
Yeah, it is really difficult. I mean, I do sort of like try to, like, for example, a friend who is a Labour Party local politician and a very nice person, but she's really, really anti the schools starting opening up again. So I've sent her some good research literature, including things from, for example, the University of Bonn, from the BMJ, so that they're actually really good sources, and said to her, have a look at these, because I think that, you know, the threat to school has been over exaggerated, and it'll be good for children to get back. But she hasn't come back to me, and I think it is quite difficult to once people have accepted within the paradigm of thinking that that a certain thing is happening. The thing is, it does take sort of like a number of sort of like approaches from different angles, and if that doesn't happen, then the person who's coming along, like you or I, are seen as the extremists, the irrational, the people who are dangerous, rather than the people who are genuinely saying.
But it has really divided society,
it
hasn't
it? Absolutely divided, and very nastily. You know, like a group of people that I know, that my dancing class where we normally meet, I actually said that I was doing something that wasn't quite within the guidelines, and somebody responded by saying, you should be ashamed of yourself. And I'm thinking, this is a friend, you know, and she's not saying, oh dear, you're naughty, but actually saying, you should be ashamed of yourself, you know. And I just find that response sort of like really as frightening as the thing that's actually happening.
Well, totally understandable, but yeah. You know, we've also seen, haven't we, a lot of change. I think I've seen a lot of change in search engines like Google, because you can be searching for something which you know all the search terms, you put the title in and everything, it's not there. Then you use a different search engine and it pops up there. It is right at the very top. So I mean, we did at the National Union of Journalists a debate a few years ago at the they call DM, which is the kind of democratic place where everyone comes together, a delegate meeting, about Google being used to skew results for politicians. But this is a whole area which is being used. I mean, the idea is that the surveys in the States have shown that it's very, very easy for Google to just click, 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 and you get positive results about one politician, and click, 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 and you get negative results about another one. So they're obviously in a position to take money in order to make someone look better or look worse.
Absolutely.
Now, they can do the same sort of thing, and they are doing, quite obvious to me. I mean, I would suggest you go on Google and look for the film The Truth About Vaccines. You know, what with the coronavirus vaccine potentially coming down the line, obviously there's a big debate there to be had about how, you know, much money is in vaccines. So that film, you will not find it on Google, and yet it's the main thing. If you put The Truth About Vaccines in, it should be at the top. It's not. So there's a lot of, you know, censorship on all sorts of levels. This one, so I'm boiling down to say here, it's coming across as actually binning of real journalism, binning of real free speech, strangling of real journalism, and an assault on intellect, really.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. I mean, when you talk about power, I mean, power doesn't just exist on one level, it exists on all levels. And what I've been really surprised about is how quickly people have internalized this new reality, this new strange reality that they shouldn't be embracing. I mean, for example, my daughter has got three children aged between 15 going down to 9, is just like can't believe that none of them are missing their friends, that they actually have built this sort of like new world that they seem to be content
well,
to
exist. Well, maybe seeing them on social media.
Yeah, they're seeing them on social media, and they seem to be content with that, and content to not have not go back to school, not meet up with their friends. They're not even attempting to meet up with their friends.
What we're going into this world now where it's okay to be against the lockdown, against the government or against these policies, but you're not allowed to back it up with an intellectual argument.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So where are we heading with all that then? Because that sounds to me actually like, you know, the end of free speech, the end of real intellect in this country. if you're going to do that for something so important as the pandemic, you're just going to ban intellectual responses against what the government is planning. And it may even be the government is pushing back against that. But there's something else going on a much bigger international level.
Exactly, there is. Yeah, I mean, I think that, for example, a lot of... when you look at the SAGE reports, until sort of Ferguson came along, it seemed as if the government was definitely sort of like leaning towards, you know, not taking such extreme reaction. And, of course, taking similar action to Sweden. But as soon as the Imperial College sort of model stepped in, then almost straight away they adopted the more extreme versions. And the other thing now, of course, despite there being so much research saying that masks aren't very effective, strangely enough, at the very end of the epidemic, suddenly they're expecting people to wear masks.
Well, they're not expecting everybody, are they? They're expecting poor people who have to use public transport to use masks. Also, you have to, if you're going to have any hospital treatment, you've got to wear a mask. Yeah. And yet, are you saying that the evidence was that the masks aren't really that effective?
I think the only evidence of places where masks are effective are in enclosed spaces where you actually have somebody who is known to be a COVID
carrier.
This
is the other point, is apparently the COVID-19 is dying out. And it's
absolutely. It is. Look, if you
and yet, suddenly you've got to then do something which you maybe should have done 5 months ago.
And things like isolating people when they move into UK. I mean, I had a friend that came back from Australia at the peak of the epidemic, and she was quite amazed because she was able to walk in through Heathrow Airport. There were no posters, there was no leaflets, there was no advice that she was self-isolate. She'd actually heard from the internet that she'd got to self-isolate for 2 weeks, so she did that. And you came in too from New Zealand, but there was no suggestion that anyone should self-isolate. Even for example, the outbreak in Liverpool happened because they allowed fans from Spain, from a place which had a very high COVID outbreak, to actually go. They allowed the fans to go to Liverpool, and that caused a sort of like the outbreak in Liverpool. So there was no suggestion of self-isolating when the virus was at its highest, and now that it's almost at the point of dying down, they're bringing in things like masks and self-isolation.
It almost seems to me like it's an enormous insult to your one's intelligence to be told you've got to wear a mask when the evidence is, number one, that the mask is really not going to make much difference, and secondly, that there's no... So it's almost like if you put a mask on, you're exhibiting your irrationality, and yet you're enforced. You've got to do that.
Yeah, it's a sort of like an exercise in control, isn't it? Where you're, you know, for example, if you know that the speed limit is 30, but you might sometimes drive at 32 miles an hour in a 30 miles an hour limit, intellectually you say, well, this isn't very much different to 30, and this piece of road hasn't got any pedestrians or any other cars, so it's okay. And you can sort of like intellectualize and sort of like work out that that's okay, but you're not allowed to do it with the masks, not only from the point of view of any censorship by the government or even any penalties by the government, but because of the censorship of your fellow human beings.
Amazing. Anyway, where do you think we're heading with all of this? Because we're being told that you're going to have to continue to wear masks if you're going to go in for any hospital treatment. And you're going to have to, if you're using public transport, really until there's a vaccine arrives. And that certainly the record of the vaccine companies is pretty horrific in many, many cases. I mean, say, for example, even a hepatitis B vaccine, which is given to infants, you can't catch it through anything except intravenous injections, and you can't catch it through... I think you can also catch it through sex acts.
Yeah.
I mean, but what is the point of giving that? to an infant that's just been born, it doesn't really seem to make any sense at all. So there's an irrationality in the vaccine world as well, but we've got to be told that we can only get out of this mask world, and once we had this vaccine, which is coming from these companies that have got a track record of absolute, I mean, death and murder, really.
Yeah, in, absolutely.
I mean, just before this lockdown started, Judith, we had a, did a programme about the documentary which aired on the BBC back in November one evening, called Cold Case Hammarskjöld, and it was an investigation into the far-right white supremacist private army in South Africa that killed the Secretary-General of the United Nations, I think it was in 1963, Dag Hammarskjöld, because he was there trying to stop a war, and the big mining companies didn't want him to, so they got this private army to kill him. But at the towards the end of that investigation that the Swedish filmmakers and the Danish investigative journalists were doing down in South Africa, they discovered absolute cast iron evidence and witness testimony that AIDS was being deliberately injected into black Africans to kill them as a result of, or under the guise of, being a vaccination program.
Yeah.
So we're going to vaccinate you against AIDS. What they were really doing was curing, getting black people to queue up to be injected with AIDS. So what we've got here is the vaccine question is going to definitely
Absolutely.
Going to be coming down the line.
Absolutely.
What do, yeah. What do we
yeah.
do?
I know, and it is an incredible problem. And I'm not against vaccines per se. I think that there's a lot of vaccines that do a lot of good. I've had vaccinations myself.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
I think the other thing, to interrupt you again, is I did a whole load of reporting on Gulf War syndrome years ago.
Yeah.
And it became absolutely clear to me, from all the evidence I saw, that the Gulf War syndrome, with these people coming back from fighting, this is, I think it was during the first Gulf War, in around 1990, that the British military personnel had been injected with loads of different vaccines and serums stuff all at the same time.
Yeah.
So one of them on its own might have been okay for your body, but when you get 10 at once, it just overwhelms your immune system and it can damage you permanently.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's exactly what's happening with vaccines now. So the vaccines are being approved as an individual vaccine, and then they're being
combined.
Given to infants, which they haven't been approved for, and they're also being combined into sometimes five or six different vaccines in one shot.
Yeah, and I mean, the quite interesting thing is that I read a study that showed that people who had a flu vaccine were actually 30% more likely to catch the coronavirus. It actually increased their chances of getting the coronavirus. And yet I still see now that there's a government campaign to try and get people to have the flu vaccine, almost as if they must have read the same research as me. If it hasn't gone to Sage, then I'd like to know why it didn't go to Sage. It was in the BMJ. So therefore, they should be, if they want to get rid of the coronavirus, they really should be distracting people from having a flu vaccine. But they've got a campaign now saying it's not too late to have the flu vaccine, and the one that's circulating now is very effective for the circulating for the vaccine and the circulating flu are compatible, so it would be very effective. But now in summer people don't get flu, so why have they got a campaign to say that at the very time that in research in the BMJ has actually shown that if you take the flu vaccine it's going to increase your chances of getting coronavirus? But I think that I've been trying to find a vaccine against the coronavirus since the 1960s. I mean, for example, there was research at the Common Cold Research Centre at Porton Down, for which a lot of students went to try.
Okay, so that was actually a little bit up from Porton Down. It was in Salisbury, because I was a reporter there at the BBC. I did a report on the Common Cold Research Centre. I think it was called Harvard Hospital at the south end of Salisbury. So although it was actually part of Porton Down, we've since found, and I think it's Steve Brodie, he was the Home Affairs correspondent for Points West, did a massive expose 10 years or so ago explaining how Porton Down guinea pigs had been murdered by brought down by the military experimenting with these sorts of viruses on them.
Yeah, yes, because you could go there as a student, have 2 weeks paid holiday, and then you were given coronaviruses. So there's been research going on for coronaviruses since the 1960s, to my knowledge, and I don't actually know researcher, an American researcher, who's been researching coronavirus, and he said that because coronavirus, like flu virus, tends to mutate quite quickly, and there's been 30 mutations of this particular coronavirus already now, that you're never going to have an effective vaccine for coronavirus. It's just like you're never going to have a truly effective vaccine for flu. The influenza vaccine gives you a 10% reduced chance of getting flu. It doesn't stop you having flu. And I don't feel it's worthwhile having a vaccine to give me a 10% immunity when it's a disease that I've only had twice in my life.
Well, also when the vaccines can have all sorts of nasty side effects too. But anyway, look, just to wind up, what can we do about this? It's an assault on intellect. It's a censorship. The idea is we're trying to bring in some sort of contact tracing system, which could end up being a bit like the sort of surveillance that you get in China, which has been going on with the, sort of enormous amounts of personal information and profiling on of individuals. So what can we do about it all, Judah?
Well, I mean, it almost seems as if, they've won, except that whoever they are. But I just think that this is too important an issue, because this is a question of mass population, the mass imprisonment of world population with the consent of that population. And I just feel that means that whilst that's happening, the super elites can treat us as they wish, both our wealth, both our health, our survival. And so I think it's a really important matter. I think that like-minded people have initially got to find a way of communicating with each other and meeting with each other, so that we can actually, instead of just protesting, but actually devise a plan so that we can have counter-information that will start being effective. But I think that's difficult to do whilst the lockdown, and I think the other difficult thing is that it's difficult to do whilst so many of us are communicating via social media, because the powers that be are going to know that we're communicating, are going to have advance notice.
Well, the thing is, Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook is making so much money out of the lockdowns and the virus that he's not going to allow the intellectuals to get out through his platform. And I think the only positive thing I'd like to say really is that I think the elite have possibly gone too far. There's lots and lots of people out there who don't believe that the virus and the lockdown has been effective. The people in this country have led the government out of the lockdown by their actions. The government's realising, well, we can't control people that much, so we're going to have to just ease off a little bit. So maybe there is a bit of hope there.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, the government are trying to open schools, but the difficulty is that the unions are sort of like have stopped it happening. I think we have to, this is so important, Tony, that I think that somehow or other we have to find a way through this to actually inform more people of what's going on.
And we also, I think we need to be quite clear about what we do want, which is a sort of manifesto for social justice, rather like the yellow vests in Paris had. Because, of course, this is another, we haven't even mentioned, that whole movement was getting very militant, very powerful, threatening the government. And now, of course, it's been totally criminalised.
Yeah, and exactly the same has happened in India, of course, with the nationalist law passed, which discriminated strongly against Muslims. The Muslim community was protesting against it, and now they've been criminalised as well. So it's not only happening in France; it's happening in other places too.
If you could just remind us of some of those websites to do with Yemen and also possibly to do with the virus that you recommend.
There's Middle East Eye, which is a Middle East magazine, and also the other, Sana'a Center for Strategic Studies, which is an academic site run by Yemenis, and in which they give regular updates of what's happening and also discussion on important topics in Yemen.
And I would thoroughly recommend the Off Guardian website, who seems to be doing a superb job on the coronavirus. And actually, I think in a way, it means that everybody is going to have to get engaged in this to actively go out and find the truth. It seems to me that we're being swamped by propaganda and lies, very much like in Nazi Germany, actually. Yeah. Because one of the things that people forget is that even during the Second World War, we didn't block the Nazi propaganda service, which was in English, which was William Joyce broadcasting Lord Haw Haw.
Yeah.
We didn't. There was a decision made. No, we'll let Lord Haw Haw broadcast, and then we'll have things on the BBC satirising him and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But the idea, as soon as you start censoring it, basically you've lost the argument.
Yeah. I think there is this other website which I've recently discovered in America called Hector Drummond. They've got some quite amazing journalists covering quite a lot of things that directly linked to UK, like NHS data, the SAGE minutes, and they're doing a really good job on that.
Well, that's the other thing to say, I suppose, is that we've got to think of ourselves, I suppose, as in the English language, as in solidarity with campaigners in the US as well.
Absolutely.
Okay, Judith Brown, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
So that's Dr. Judith Brown from Somerset speaking to me earlier this week. One thing to add from that, though, and there are various people who have sent me, I think, a fascinating article. Well, it's not an article, it's a book, very quickly written by a guy called Logan Christopher. And the, I suppose, pinch point in all of this has been the World Health Organization. These are the guys who now is the main funding for the World Health Organization comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. It's effectively been privatized. It's not governments paying for this organization, this arm of the United Nations anymore. And Logan Christopher has looked at the World Health Organization and published this e-book called Corruption of the World Health Organization. Now, he looks at all sorts of historical problems with it, and specifically has a whole section of the book looking at the guy who's in charge, Tedros a terribly difficult name to pronounce, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, who is the Director General of the World Health Organization, and his history, who he is and who owns him, who pulls his strings, and also the enormous amounts of industry input. For example, the tobacco industry inputting into the World Health Organization is pretty eye-opening. The enormous amount of money that's been being channeled to World Health Organization people from the big pharmaceutical companies. The World Health Organization fueling the opioid epidemic is one chapter. And it just goes on and on. The swine flu, H1N1 pandemic, he looks at particularly, as well as the conflicts of interest, the Chernobyl and the World Health Organization's reaction to that, Fukushima and the World Health Organization's reaction to that. It goes on and on. But anyway, I'll put a link up to Corruption of the World Health Organization by Logan Christopher on our show page. His website, loganchristopher.com, and our show page, thisweek.org.uk. So thanks very much to Dr. Judith Brown. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest in the first hour. Well, he wasn't really a guest. He's always on, isn't he? That's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like, actually. You'll find this week's podcast, story links and comment page, and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. There's Sunday evenings at 7 with Danny Lopsch, a particularly good show to have a listen to. And BCFM boss Pat Hart did say our sister show Dialect would be on BCFM every Monday at 10 p.m. So far it hasn't been. We'll be back on FM soon when other shows return on the week of the 20th of June, hopefully, Pat Hart willing. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at the old time at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.